Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another special episode of the Motorsport Republica podcast. This week we are joined by ASBK rider Mike Jones. How are you, mate?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having us on here. Much appreciated.
No worries, Jack Moans.
Got there.
Good old Lukey Luke.
We'll make sure we pass that on to him.
Yeah. I'm sure he'd be ecstatic about that one.
He's like, you got to do it. He was all over it. Good friend of the pod.
That's right. He's a good man. What's been going on? How's the weekend been? Week been, I guess you'd say, so far.
Yeah, everything's good. So what are we today? Today's Thursday, big day of, getting down to the island and set up and all the prep and everything leading into the weekend. But yeah, the week leading up is just a cruisy sort of one, like training sort of starts going down, as in like, take it easy and sort of like taper into the weekend. So just mentally preparing, getting ready for the weekend, and now we're here. It's all time to go. So it's very exciting. Like I get obviously a combination of nerves, but excitement as well. Nerves is always a funny one going into the weekends, because I find like before I get excited, I'm nervous initially, but then once we hit the weekend, then it's all exciting.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
So some maybe a bit like back to front compared to other people.
Well, yeah,
maybe excitement first and then nerves for them.
Yeah, maybe. Look, I think, like I said, like when you're leading into the weekend, as a rider and a competitor, you're always envisaging that you're going to be at the pointy end and you want to win races and all sorts of stuff. That's what brings. You don't know whether you're going to be able to do that or not. So that's what brings the nervousness, I think. But then once the weekend gets started and it all starts happening, you're excited to be there, and it's such a great feeling to be on the bike. So then from that point on, you're just so focused that you sort of don't worry too much about the nerves anymore.
That's good. There you go. What about when you're on the start line, kind of just looking down the front straight? Is it still a bit butterflies?
It is. I think I notice at the start of the races, it's always you can feel your heartbeat the most.
Yeah.
Big thuds of the heart, and that's just that adrenaline going. Because you know that you're about to send yourself around the track with like 15 or 20 other guys, 200-300k an hour. And it's I think the start of the race is always the most tricky or challenging, because if you haven't had a great qualifying position and you're sort of back in the pack, that's where all the excitement is, So, for sure, it's nerve-wracking on the line. But once you get started into it, it's just full focus, 100%.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I couldn't imagine it being the most pleasant feeling starting a bit further back. But hopefully this year, not too much of that for you.
Yeah, look, I suppose over the years, especially when you're first coming into the category, that's part of dealing with it. You're just not at the pointy end, so you've got to deal with that. You're in the mix with a bunch of people, and everyone's so aggressive trying to fight for the position in those early few turns on that first lap or two. But the fortunate thing is that as you get more experience in the category and you do get faster, generally speaking, you'll qualify better, and that puts you in a much better place for the race start. So, and also too, what comes with that is a sense of confidence. When you qualify at the pointy end, like on that front row or the first two rows, you sort of go into the race hungry and like you're sort of a bit more of an attack mode rather than like
survival mode.
Yeah, you get a bit scared, I suppose, when you're further back for sure. So, yeah.
That's true. Yeah. I was just going to ask, obviously coming into this weekend, tyres, obviously just found out the World Supersport and World Superbikes are doing a tyre change halfway through because of the asphalt. How do you kind of make it that situation and for yourself?
Yeah, look, I think I rode on the track, must have been about 4 weeks or so ago. Yeah. We come down, did some ride days. They were immediately after the track had been resurfaced. So we were the first people on the track. And obviously immediately the track's very abrasive. It's got more grip, so it's quicker, but that comes with the fact that it's going to be a little bit more aggressive on the tyre. So even when we were on the track, it was hard to know for sure how it would sort of like clean up, I suppose, over the few weeks leading up to now. But it sounds like even for the World Superbike guys and the World Supersport riders, it's still not at a level where, it's going to take probably, I imagine it taking, another year or two, possibly even based on past resurfaces that have been done. It always seems to take a few years before it gets to a point.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so in terms of a like a flag to flag style race that they're going to do this weekend, like it just adds another element of
100%
complexity. You know what I mean? Like it's hard enough just start a race and then going to the end, let alone having to try to time your pit stop or working out how to manage the tire and everything. So, yeah, I think though it's a bit different for our races. Our races are a little bit shorter. We're about 12 lap races. And we will be able to get to the end of 12 laps on our tyres. Mm. But nonetheless, I still think that around the sort of 8-9 lap mark is where we'll see tyre start to degrade quite a lot, and the last 3 or 4 laps will be a little bit tricky. So, having a setup with the bike that, you know, you want to try to go fast and have a lot of speed, but you've got to compromise and not wear the tyre too much. So you've got to find the balance there that you can, you know, go quick enough for the whole race distance for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's interesting as well. You with resurfacing of tracks, Philippon would probably take a lot longer than other places as well, because like in Europe they are used, you know, six times a day every day. You know, they might have a siesta on a Monday and that's about it, legit. But like even in Philippon or Aussie tracks, I've heard like if it rains a little bit they'll can everything. Where in Europe it's just balls to the wall, you know, so they'll rub it in so much quicker.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the thing. I think that, like, you know, and those circuits over there, they get plenty of cars and stuff on them as well. So, and it's just, they're so far into motorsport, it's not funny. And that's right. The tracks are just getting used all the time. Mm. Yeah, almost every hour of the day. So, yeah, for sure, being able to run a track in would probably be faster than what we get here in Oz. Definitely.
Yeah, that's right. Especially in like Philippon, the middle of winter, like how many people are riding down there? Like, you get cars, but.
Yeah,
it's pretty dormant.
It does, and especially being Phillip Island as well. Like the, you know, with the weather here, you don't know it
at the best of times.
That's it. As you go into winter and a little bit later in the year, like it's not a place that you want to be really enjoying riding your motorcycle around. So.
No, that's all right. Like for one of the best tracks in the world, it can still be pretty rough.
I reckon we got to tow it up home. We tow the island up home up to the Gold Coast and have it up there. It'd be so much better.
You're the second person I've heard say that.
Too far for us, but.
Yeah.
Daniel will catch on fire. We overheat up in Queensland.
Yeah, so would Tom, I reckon.
Yeah.
We'd struggle up there. But my bike barely lasted 8 laps around here and it was cool conditions. Imagine up there when it's scorching hot. I wouldn't even get out of pit lane.
Yeah, you'd start at 120 kegs and come back at 95, I reckon.
That's a bit stiff.
Sorry, mate.
A bit rough, eh?
Sorry, ladies. More to love, but, you know.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's what they say anyway. You know. I'm the punching bag in this show. Don't cry about it tonight, it's all good.
Yeah, fair. I hear you crying.
So it is going to make for a very interesting weekend, though, all jokes aside, for all you guys, all the categories, both ASBK and the world stage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be, it's going to add that element of difficulty to it. Where in the past you've come here and you've just focused on trying to go as fast as you can, now you've got to sort of worry about how your tyre's going. And also, too, I think World Superbike and World Supersport are a little bit more restricted with what tyre they actually use. So, I mean, obviously everyone uses Pirelli, but they bring a different, style or model of the tyre. Yeah. I think for this weekend, I'm not 100% certain, but I'm pretty sure that they bring maybe only one or two sort of options for this track, which they normally do anyway because the nature of this circuit, it has such a high speed, like it's such a high average speed and such a long time on the left-hand side of the tyre. So it just generates so much heat in the tyre. So, yeah, they have a special sort of tyre for this particular circuit. It's a little bit different for our category. I think we've got 3 different options for the tyre, for the rear tyre. We have a soft sort of medium, you'd say, and then a Phillip Island special type tyre.
Yeah.
Like you've got to try to work out then which tyre is going to work for your bike and your riding style and all that kind of stuff too. So that's a little bit more tricky as well, because in the past you pretty much come here and you just know which tyre you're going to run and just you know what the track's going to be like. It's going to be sweet and there's not a whole lot to worry about apart from just getting your eye in and sort of getting into it, you know. But it'll be a little bit more tricky this weekend.
That's right. Has your riding style adapted over the years as technology's progressed in obviously like, you know, being in an R1 or Panigales or ZX10s, whatever it is, and bikes have progressed?
Yeah, that's a tricky question, I'd say. I mean, I feel like I'm always progressing with my riding just from year to year or even from round to round almost, you know what I mean? Like I'm always trying to find ways to refine it and make it better. Yeah. In terms of like, say, going with technology or the bikes, I'd say to a certain extent, yeah, like we've got a little bit more electronic than what there used to be. But the electronic now is just it's a little bit more refined, so it just works a little bit smoother and a little bit better. It probably allows you to be maybe a little bit lazier, particularly with the throttle. Just means that through the turn, you know, you can sort of get a little bit lazy with the throttle opening because you know that if you get a bit heavy with it, the traction control is going to be there.
Sort of, anyway.
Yeah. Whereas in the past, I'd say you'd probably had to be a little bit more ginger with the gas and have a good connection between the throttle and your feeling with the rear tire to feel the slide and stuff because the electronic and the traction control wasn't as refined. So it just didn't sort of quite catch it as well. So, yeah, maybe it's gone the opposite way to making it better.
made it worse.
Yeah. But, look, I still think though, like, it's what it's done with the electronic side of stuff with the bikes. It's just, it's changed the way that bikes get ridden. So like I said, you could do a lot with, you know, when you're as a rider, you were doing a lot in your hand with the throttle. You could steer the bike with the rear and all this kind of stuff. Well, it's a little bit different now with electronics and you, like, again, you just sort of end up rolling the gas on and letting the electronic do it for you. So there's a lot more rider and technician working together to try and refine the electronic to get the feeling that the rider wants.
Yeah.
More so than the rider just going riding, cutting laps and trying to play around with it in their hand. So it's just a different sort of dynamic, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it, I suppose. How do you find, do you prefer front end feeling or do you don't mind the rear sliding around at the back?
Yeah, look, I'm very, if you've watched my riding, I'm very smooth and wheels in line mostly. I don't tend to like the bike moving around a great deal. So for me, like having more electronic is actually kind of better. I feel that I'm very sensitive with my sensation of traction. So I can feel like, to me, it feels like it's a big slide, but it's actually tiny little bit. To me, it feels like it's a lot. So I like to have a lot of control over the bike and that type of thing. So it's such a different thing between each ride. Everybody's a bit different, you know. Some people ride it loose and out of control almost. And yeah, like I said, I'd try to be a little bit more in line, two wheels in line for sure.
That's what I love about motorcycle racing though, is there's so many different styles, but it can produce the exact same lap time.
Yep.
You know, you could see, I always say this, I'm sorry to all our listeners, but Jorge Lorenzo for me is, I think, the most, a magician on rails.
Yeah.
And then you had Casey Stoner, same era, different bike, but he was sliding around everywhere and they could still pull the same lap time. So it's incredible how you got two different bikes, two different riders, but they can still
100%
for two different ways, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's really no such thing, I guess, as the right way.
Well, no, there isn't. No, that's right. There's probably just easier and more difficult maybe. Yep. But there's not really a right way. And it is interesting and it's good from a spectator's point of view with motorcycles that you can – it's animated, you know, you can see it a lot. So whereas from a car point of view, if they were different, you probably can't, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to tell, you know what I mean? So it's a bit harder.
Yeah, you have a bit more of a sort of like fine eye for it, I
guess.
Yeah, for sure.
Or see the data, you know?
Yeah.
You'd probably have to see the data of where they're braking later or something where you know, you can see a rider, you know.
Getting out of shape or
wrestle the bike around a bit more. Someone looks a bit smoother. It's a cool thing about bikes, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a lot more animated.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's all like Binder and, you know, Jack on the KDMs. Marquez the same. Getting it all sort of loose in that.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, and for years, like Rossi, he was always pretty smooth.
Yep.
You know, he was always pretty elegant. So it's just, I love it. It's a very cool thing about bikes. Where did the love for bikes start for you?
Yeah, look, I was brought into the idea of motorcycle riding by my dad when I was very, very little. I think I maybe first started on a motorbike when I was about 2.5 or 3 years old, so very, very young.
Very young.
On a Peewee 50 in the paddock. That's where it first started and it was just like dad was an influence, but it was obviously I don't recall it very well. Like it was so young, so long ago, but it was something that I enjoyed doing. You know, wanted to go riding. The thing that I remember the most is crashing the bike and then not wanting to ride
it. Bit of that.
But once I got overcome that, then I've always loved and enjoyed riding bikes and not just riding bikes. I wouldn't say that I don't say that I have a love for riding the bike as such. I I enjoy racing and competing the bike.
Yeah.
Trying to extract the most out of yourself and also like compare yourself against the other guys. Mm. So yeah, that's what's most enjoyable for sure. But yeah, it started when I was very, very young, and it's, yeah, that was 2.5, 3 years old, and I'm going to be 30 on Sunday. So it's,
oh, wow.
There you go.
Been going
go.
A while.
Big 3-0.
Been going a while.
And did you go, it seems, with just about everyone I've ever spoken to dirt, motocross, flat track, that type of thing?
Great. This is perfect because I didn't do any
of
that.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. First one.
Yeah.
So funny because I started on a Peewee 50 and I started on a dirt bike in the paddock, and I progressed to, I think it was a Peewee 80 and then maybe an XR 80.
Yeah.
I think that's as far as I went on dirt bikes. My old man took me to a racetrack one time, the only time. I absolutely hated it. I must have been about, I don't know, maybe 5, 6 or 7 years old, somewhere around there. Absolutely hated it. Never ever went back again. That was to a motocross track. I really wish, looking back on it now, I've been and watched flat track.
Yeah.
And I really wish that I would have had the opportunity to go and do flat track, because I reckon that would have been awesome. But yeah, nonetheless, I didn't start down that path. I just rode in the paddock. My dad and my brother, we used to go and ride in the bush. Just recreationally for fun. And I actually started on the bitumen circuit racing on mini moto when I was about 9 or 10 years old.
Okay.
So that's sort of my how my pathway into racing started. Yeah, that was the first time I started racing, and being on the bitumen was on mini moto.
Right, right. And what series and bikes were they?
Yeah, so they were called pocket bikes, yeah, mini moto, whatever you want to call them. There's a few different brands. There was Chinese built bikes that were, they were called Blada was the brand. I also had an Italian built bike that was called DM. There was a bunch of different styles and models, types of bikes, but they were 40cc or 50cc engines. Some were air cooled, some were water cooled. And at that time it was like a craze. Like, I think it was around about 2005 and 2006, it was really, really big on the, like, I live in Brisbane, Gold Coast area, so it was really big on the Gold Coast and really big at another place called Archerfield, next to the Speedway. There was a drift track there and they raced them around there. So, like, you'd go to an event on they ran it on a Saturday night down at the Gold Coast, and, like, there was, like, 120 entries or 150 entries.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's a lot.
It was massive. That's huge. Yeah, it was huge. They had... It was a lot of adults, surprisingly, like these tiny little tiny little bikes, but a lot of adults were out there racing them and they're having a blast on them. But and from a kid's point of view, like, I mean, this type of bike was like riding a super bike or a GP bike. You know what I mean? You're a tiny kid on this little bike. So it was just like, the ratio was right. And like, it was just, I can't remember really what, if it was a series or what, but I just remember going on the track, doing lots of practice, lots of racing, and it was just a blast. It was so much fun. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, that's wicked.
That is cool. You're right with how it was a bit of a thing back then, because for our Victorian listeners will know, and Daniel will know, South Morang had a racetrack, a little go-kart track. I think they were Peewee 80s or something like that. They could have been those little Chinese bikes as well. And every weekend it was a massive, put little road tires on them, and we'd go as a family and ride them around. Well, my brother did, and my dad as well. But it was a whole thing even back then. So
yeah, it was massive. I think at one stage you could have go-karts and the pocket bikes on there at once.
Yeah.
So it was huge. I remember going as a kid also.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, I just remember it being massive for a good two or three years maybe, and then like that was it, and sort of died right off. You know, it was just huge for a short amount of time, and the timing was just perfect. It was just like that age for me. I think I must have been about 10 or 11 years old or whatever, and that's how I got started, and it's cool. springboarded me into road racing from that point. Unreal.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And what was the progression into road racing then? What was the pathway? Obviously now we've got Junior 300 and all that kind of stuff. What was it for you?
Yeah, so like how we see now, we've got the Oceania Junior Cup with the Yamaha R15s. At that point in time, like, again, it was just timing. It was just like it was meant to be, you know. Like, perfect. I just was racing these pocket bikes for a couple of years. And then in 2007, There was a series that started. It was called the Motorcycle Road Race Development Association, and it was Honda 150s at the time.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And it ran for the three, maybe a few years. Yeah. You know, it was pretty big in the first couple of years that it started. And it raced, like, it was kind of nationally. It sort of, you know, we raced at Phillip Island, we raced in Goulburn at Wakefield Park and Queensland Raceway, you know, up and down the East Coast sort of thing. And I did that for 2 years. So, yeah, it was just like, I remember reading Australian Motorcycle News. Old man, used to religiously buy the Australian Motorcycle News.
Yeah, yeah.
Big ad for it, MRRDA, sign up your kid, all this kind of stuff. And, yeah, 2007 was my first year racing a 150 on the bigger circuits.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
A part of a national championship, and yeah, I guess that was then the real sort of stepping stone into road racing, because after that it was more or less doing the same thing but just on the next size bike, and it was just a progression from bike to bike, you know, basically. So, but that was, yeah, like for me, that was it was a timing thing, but it was just the absolute perfect thing to do at that time. Yeah. Like as a kid, you know, I was 13 going racing a 150.
Just living the dream.
Just was unreal, yeah.
Yeah, it just all fallen into place perfectly.
It really did. And like the thing is though, without that opportunity, you probably, that's why people do go from the typical sort of style that you talk about, like you do flat track or dirt track or, you know, motocross or whatever, and then transition into road racing a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But for me, it was a little bit different. All this stuff lined up and it was the way to go.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like we said, you know, you're the first person that we've had that's taken that route. And it's interesting to see, you know, how young you're starting on those little pocket bikes and the progression through that.
Hey guys, it's James from Motorsport Republica. Just want to give a shout out to HJC Australia. They have a brand new helmet coming out, the R412. Make sure you head down to your local dealer to check it out. It's got max defogging, 4 intakes, 3 exhaust vents. It comes with 4 different shell sizes and 5 different liners. It's got lift force and drag force reduced, optimized air ventilation. This helmet is an awesome new street helmet. Make sure you check it out. Go to hjc.com. Go to your local dealer and you better grab yours today. Thanks.
So those early doors, what was it like gaining sponsorship? Were you cold calling people? Were there people approaching you? Like,
we call it the Lukey Luke technique.
Yeah. Were you hard headed? Like, were you just busting people's balls all the time?
When I first started road racing, obviously, I was 13, 14 years old. It was a while back. I can't really remember exactly. I mean, at that point in time, I just remember Dad going to work. Like, he just worked so much to be able to afford it for me to go racing. So he was the biggest sponsor. But for him, he was so passionate about it. Like when we talked about me getting started in racing, it came through Dad. And then the whole time, like, Dad's just been so passionate about going racing. So he's always been the number one there to take me racing, you know. In terms of getting other sponsors, it's always been a networking thing, you know.
Of course.
Like, just within the industry, you get to know somebody, they know somebody else, and, you know, just...
Yeah.
It's, you know, you're always... requiring sponsorship to go racing and, you know, achieve your next step in the progression of your career and all this kind of stuff, and always seemed to be able to find people that were keen to help out. But I'd say what I've found with getting sponsors, it's always been more of a personal thing rather than like a commercial thing. Like, it's been pretty tough to try and sell it as a commercial thing.
Yeah.
As you'd probably know, being in the industry, you know, it's pretty tough to do it that way. And it's always just been getting to know people and more or less end up becoming friends with them, you know, really that's what happens. And, they like what you're doing. They're keen to help out. They understand what's involved to do it, and that a financial, you know, part of it's necessary to go racing. So they've been able to, be in a position that they were able to and keen to help out. And that's pretty much been the biggest things. Yeah, just networking and getting to know people and, trying to generate friendships that, you know, have a mutual interest.
Yeah, of course, it's just more than just trying to chase that one thing, you know, like you said, build that rapport and continue it on.
Definitely, yeah, 100%. And over my years of racing, like I said, going to be 30, so I've been doing it for a while now, that seems to be like having that relationship and like trying to keep partnerships going, you know, even after they're finished, you know, is something that's pretty important, you know what I mean? Like, people that want to help you out, even if it stops, doesn't mean that the friendship or the partnership needs to end. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, you keep in touch with those people and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, they don't have to help you out. They're doing it because they want to. And so that's pretty important, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I suppose a lot of the times, or not a lot of times, but most of the times, they've probably been in that position as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's it. And I think that's where like they come from a place that they can see what it is that you're doing, and then they want to help out for sure.
Yeah,
that's true. And it's the bike industry, especially in Australia, is quite small. So everyone knows everyone.
Yeah.
So whatever you do, they're gonna find out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I can't recall who's told me this stuff over the years, but it was either maybe Vermeulen or Stoner, some people that are involved with those guys. Like I've heard it numerous times, is that how you treat people on your way up is more or less how you get treated on your way down. You know what I mean? So if you're just burning bridges all the time, well, it's going to come crashing down on you at some point. You know, so if you try and try and do the right thing throughout your career, then as you keep progressing, everyone's always keen to keep helping you out for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really, really cool.
Yeah. Now with that, did you always have the goal of going overseas? And obviously you did some super stock stuff that I'm sure I would like to know your pathway of how you got over there and, basically your pathway of getting over there, because financially and just personally, that's a massive, massive thing to do coming from Australia. And just side note, we'll speak into Philip Ottle, and he's like massive respect for people out of Australia or Japan coming over to Europe because, you got to change your whole life. Like, it's not like you can catch a bullet train back to Spain or something like that, whatever it is.
That's right, they're already there. They got so much more access compared to everyone else, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's it. Like, coming from Oz, you grow up here at home, and if you're racing here in Australia, well then once you finish going racing for the weekend, you just go back home, go to bed. Mm. It's all normal, but of course when you go over there, well, it's completely different world, because you're not only is it your living environment that you're in, but also like your friendship and family and like all those relationships and everything. You don't have that connection over there, in terms of like getting to the question that you asked initially, I'd say as a kid growing up, I was watching Valentino. One of the number 46, big fan of Rossi, obviously. But watching him race and dominate and win and all that sort of stuff, like, that was just the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And like, as a kid, when you're watching all that, you're like, that's what I want to do, So, always had the goal of wanting to be able to race in a world championship, whether it's World Superbike or GP. And that had always been my goal, to be able to achieve that. Just the way things panned out, through the different categories that I progressed, I ended up, once I got to, say, Superbike here in Australia, ended up riding for the Desmo Sport Ducati team. That was Troy Bayliss and Ben Henry running the team. Very fortunate that, again, it was just a timing thing. However the opportunity came about, that Troy was involved, and he was very supportive of me, not only here in Oz, but he helped generate that ride overseas. And again, another thing, it was just opportunistic. The Aruba Ducati team in the Superstock Championship, they were intending to run their same two riders again that year. One of the riders opted to go and do something else, so it just left a seat available.
Perfect.
Troy had the connection, put my name forward, it all fell into place, so I ended up with a ride there. Just couldn't be more grateful for a chance like that, because how difficult it is for Aussie riders to get out of Oz and go overseas. I'd already tried in the past to want to go and do some racing overseas in Superstock 600, and like, it costs money to go and do that. Not only you got to pay for your living over there, but also to pay for the ride. It doesn't come for free. So I was super fortunate in this position that it was a paid ride. I was getting paid to ride the motorbike over there, and your expenses and everything are covered. So, it was
one less thing to worry about as well.
Absolutely. You're going there, your sole focus then is just to go and race and try and do the best you can. So, very, very fortunate to be in a position like that. And probably, I think, would be a little bit unusual, you know what I mean, for most people trying to get over there. But that's, again, that's a networking thing. Just come that's through right. word of mouth and somebody knows somebody sort of thing, you know. Otherwise, if you're trying to do it on your own, it's, yeah, way harder. But, yeah, that's pretty much how I got that ride over there. And, like, for sure, I wanted to stay there. I wanted to continue, wanted to progress, like, ultimately at a point there I could, like, it's almost like I could feel like World Superbike, yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's just there. I'm already in the paddock. I'm doing all the European rounds. I'm riding with the factory Ducati team. You know, the next step would be, you know, something like World Superbike. But it, even at that point then, you know, like I felt like in that season, I think I finished fifth of the year with a DNF in one of the rounds. So, and that's the first year in the championship. To me, my expectation, I would expect something like that, or even above it, you know what I mean? Like, I think I had a best result of second place. But the bottom line is, if you're not first place, not winning on the sheet of paper at the end of the weekend, nobody cares. So
exactly.
That's pretty much how it went at the end of the year. It's like, oh, we didn't win any races, so too bad. Again, it's just an opportunity thing. That team weren't running the following year, and that was the finish of their program, and that was it, you know what I mean? So, I was trying to sort out another ride, and again it came to a thing where it was pretty tough to find a ride. I was just lucky to somebody in the team was able to help get a ride in the Spanish Superbike Championship with a team that was a free ride, so I didn't have to pay, which is really good in terms of paying the team. It was just paying your own expenses and everything. But yeah, again, at the end of that year, then it's just getting even harder again because you've just gone away from a factory Ducati team to a to a Spanish championship with a Kawasaki team. It was just, yeah, it all just got harder and harder. So ultimately ending up back here in Oz. So looking back on that, I'd say okay, a couple of things. One is that the obvious thing is if you've got the cash to support you to keep progressing, providing that you've got the right, as a rider, you've got the potential to progress, and you've got all the other ingredients around you with the financial backing and everything, then for sure. The other thing is one thing that I probably missed a little bit over there was that I see now is that, you know, being able to get yourself in a position with a manager that sort of has the right contacts and stuff. Because again, like I've said before, is that it's not what you know, it's who you know, and the word of mouth and everything. So if you have the right person in there pushing your name forward, all the right people, then I think that could be another way of getting going without, if you didn't have the cash, you know, to be able to get there. So that was definitely something that I didn't realize at the time that I look back on and sort of see now. So
That's really interesting. I guess with the manager thing as well, like you got to obviously be fast, but you still have to be able to hustle.
Exactly.
You
know, 100%.
Damo Cudlin we were talking to, and he was handing out, was it him that was handing out resumes for races?
Yep.
When someone was in an ambo, he was already almost handing out a resume. That's the stuff I guess you just got to do.
100%.
And no one knows or hears about it, you know?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess if you get worded up on it beforehand, but otherwise it's like maybe a bit of initiative probably too. But just having that sort of in you to not just be focusing on the racing side of things, but trying to get your name out there as best you can and whatever. And maybe, like I said before, a little bit about the cold calling, like you just put your name out to any team, just go to everyone and knock on the door and just put your name there and see what happens. Because again, it's an opportunity thing. Like I said, riders get injured and they might just fill in, and next minute, you know, you get a good result and it could turn into something. So it's a tricky one, but yeah, I think you've just got to try to go full gas when you're over there and 100%. See what you can make of it for sure.
Yeah, 100%. And it's awesome that you got other guys that have been there helping you out as well, like Troy putting your name across.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like that was the massive one, like having Troy's connection there with Ducati and that team over there. Like, yeah, without that, it wouldn't have ever happened. So definitely.
Yeah.
How was your, speaking of all this, how did getting your wild cards come about for GP?
Yeah, same deal. Being associated with Troy, and talking about injury before, I think the first one was in 2016. Motegi, I think, was the first one, 2016 Motegi. Because the teams at that time, they were flying away, GP fly away to, must have been, they did Motegi, Phillip Island, Sepang.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah. So whatever happened in one of the satellite teams, or might have even been the factory team. One of the riders got injured, and so what they did, they moved one of the full time GP riders in a satellite team into the factory team.
Yeah.
And then I filled in in the satellite team just because of injury and the convenience of knowing that they'd have an Aussie rider at Phillip Island and that type of thing. So yes, yeah, so I did Motegi initially and then Phillip Island the weekend after. And yeah, look, that was just Troy put my name forward, and all the pieces of the puzzle worked out together. And yeah, I think it was Davide Tardozzi and Paolo Chattabatti. Yep. They those guys, like, that was unreal to meet them. Yep. And they took me under their wing there for a couple of weekends. Yep. And it was really, really cool. And just to experience the GP and everything, it's next level. So really cool.
What's it like being in that paddock, and how does it differ to obviously what you've been in elsewhere?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's just that it's glitz and glamour, and it's got all the money and everything, so it's all flash and fancy. But in terms of a riding, from a rider's point of view, like, you've just got everything that you need at disposal. There's no questions. Like, you just anything you want, anything you need, it's there. And like, those teams, for me, it was unreal to be able to experience that, because it gave me an insight at the level, like the level of professionalism that these teams are working at, and how the working system is inside a team, like, of that level is. So it elevated me as a rider to be able to improve my working method, basically. And I've brought that back with me to all of my other races as well, and with my other teams that I've ridden with. So yeah, to experience that was, yeah, it was just an incredible experience as a rider, for sure.
Man, 100%. I got to know, you're obviously a massive Rossi fan. When you're lining up on the grid and you can see him, and you're just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. I mean, it's so funny, because when I was a kid at primary school, the one dream that I had was not only racing, becoming a world champion or whatever, but was I wanted to race with Rossi.
Yeah.
That was a dream of mine. Yeah, I had that as a kid, and then I was like 20 something years old, and I'm lined up on the grid with Rossi. It was just like the coolest thing ever.
And like, you're in an exclusive club to be, just be on a Grand Prix bike, but then the race against him.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Look, it's just stuff that I'm so appreciative of it, more than anything. I just like look back on it, it's unreal memories for me personally. And just the best time ever. So
100%. Motegi, was it wet? I can't remember. Was it raining?
Oh, bloody hell. To be honest,
it always is.
I can't remember how it went down. I don't recall the race being wet. I think it was a dry race. I can't tell you. I'm sure it was wet at some point during the weekend. Yeah. And I think even when we come to Phillip Island, it was wet during during one of the practices or something like that. So that's the thing. Like, going, it just is blows your mind. Like, you go to a race, you're racing the best riders in the world on the best bikes in the world. You've never even ridden it before, never had a chance to practice on it before. No idea what's going on. You just rock up and into it. And the funny thing is that first round at Motegi, I think I was down here at Phillip Island supposed to be doing some testing for the Australian Superbikes. And it was like Wednesday night or something. It was middle of the night. Troy's trying to ring me in the middle of the night. I put my phone on silent, so he couldn't get hold of me. So he calls the hotel wherever at. They've come to the room, woke me up. I had to get up like in the middle of the night, get on a flight back to
Britain. Oh, no way, straight away.
Yeah, get back to Britain. Because it was like Wednesday night or something, and I had to get there. So Thursday morning, I was on a plane back to Brisbane, get my passport because I didn't have my passport with me, which Troy wasn't too stoked about. Got back to Brizzy on a plane over to Motegi. I got to Motegi at like 9 or 10 o'clock at night or something. And so I didn't even get to see the bike or the team or anything until Friday morning. I rock up to the track.
No way.
Jeez, what a shock.
What a whirlwind, seriously.
It was just a whirlwind. It's just like a dream, you know what I mean? Yeah. You couldn't think of that ever, you know what I mean? Unreal.
Absolutely. And then when you first jump on the bike, like, what's it like? And then wrapping it on the power, like, what's the power and everything like there?
Yeah, look, obviously the first time getting on the bike, it's so foreign to you, the feeling and sensation. You're just trying to get some sort of feel with it, and it's completely different to what I've been used to in terms of the bikes. Like, the super bikes are there seem to be a lot more like flexi or a lot more feeling in them, you know what I mean? You can sort of feel what the tire's doing, but once you go to a GP bike, it's so stiff and rigid and it's really hard to tell what's going on. So you spend a little bit of time trying to get a feeling for the bike. But of course, when you get to the first straight and you're trying to wrap the gas, I'm pretty sure I didn't even hold it flat the first time. It took me a little bit to get the to full throttle. The acceleration of those bikes is just
I can't
describe it like anything. Like, it's just absolutely insane. And I mean, yeah, it just blew my mind, like how fast it was. Out of, you know, just pure acceleration down the straight. So that was another thing that you're trying to comprehend, is like you've been used to your body moving at a certain sort of speed, like top speed, and being able to process everything, and then you've got this extra acceleration, extra speed that you're doing, and your brain's trying to cope with all that. So it was a lot going on. And also at the same time, you're going heaps slower than everyone else that's out there, because they're been used to riding the bike.
Yeah, they've been growing up on it.
So you're trying not to get in everybody's way and bloody cause a hassle. So yeah, it was a pretty intense and nerve-wracking experience. But
I'm sure.
Managed to. I was actually, but like looking back on it, I was pretty surprised at how I sort of ended up. I mean, by the end of qualifying, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I'd qualified not far off my teammate on the bike.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was only, you know, a few tenths or within a second. I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was reasonably close. I was like, oh, that's not, like actually not
first
too bad.
Time yeah. on the bike. First that's amazing.
Yeah. And that was something that was like, for me inside, I was like, when I was out there riding and doing it, I was like, man, if I could have some practice on this thing, like I can be racing in this field. Like I could be there, you know what I mean? Like, and that was what I said before about, like, you know, when I did the racing in Europe and stuff like that. It's like, it was the same. It's the same thing. It's like,
close.
I can be there. I can be doing it. I can see it. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I've got the ability to learn and pick it up, you know, and be fast enough to be with those guys. So yeah, that was something that I seen in the GP. It was like, you have this, you know, prior to that point and you've never been to the GP, like raced in it. You just see these guys as like gods. They're like next level. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like their skill and ability is so far above everything else that you could imagine. But once I got in there, like, hey, these people are just normal people. Like,
they're just normal guys.
They've just grown up riding these bikes and they spend a bit more time on them and they just got used to riding this type of bike, you know? So like, it's not impossible. Like it's possible to do it, you know?
100%.
So yeah, that was a real eye opener and something cool just to give you a bit of hope, I suppose, for keeping the dream alive.
That's it.
G'day guys, James here from Motorsport Republica. Our brand new t-shirts have dropped. So we have Marquez, we've got Daniel Ricciardo, we've got Verstappen, Charles Leclerc in men and women, and a Gent Lawrence, Hunter Lawrence double champs tee. Jump onto motorsportrepublica.com.au, check out our new tees. We've got air freshener still on there. Go on our socials, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. It's all on there. Make sure to check it out. All your support means everything. Thanks, guys.
Did you end up getting any wise words of knowledge or anything from any of the bosses or any of the mechanics?
Can't really recall anything fantastic from the guys. I mean, the only thing I could really say was I remember sitting in the lunch, like the catering area with, and Hervé Poncherolle was there.
Oh, yeah.
And he said to me how he was surprised at how well I was going and picking it up and everything. And he's like, oh, you're level, you should be able to race somewhere in Europe. You know what I mean? All this type of stuff. So to me, that was pretty cool. I was
definitely.
Sick. That's
like,
cool.
A guy like him sort of like giving you a bit of praise and stuff like that. One of the guys, the crew chief on that team that year in 2016, there was the Avintia Ducati team. Jarno was his name. He was said the same thing. He's like, okay, look, you might not be Troy Bayliss or you might not be Casey Stoner, you might not be, you know, World Superbike champion or MotoGP World champion a couple times or whatever, but you've got the potential to be somewhere in the paddock or somewhere in Europe racing, you know what I mean? So again, like, yeah, hearing that in that year and that time again was like a massive confidence booster for sure.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it'd make you feel on top of the world, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Really, really cool to hear that for sure.
Yeah.
Did you feel a bit more comfortable when you were in Phillip Island? I guess you knew the track a bit more.
Yeah. And look, and to having ridden the bike the weekend prior at Motegi, you know, you just sort of get a feel for it. And then you come to Phillip Island, you know the track already. You've already ridden the bike a little bit. So, yeah, coming into the weekend, it's a little bit less nerve wracking. Maybe a little bit more confidence because you think you can possibly do a little bit better. So yeah, it was definitely a lot easier having it like that, and also too just not having the stress of like waking up middle of the night and having to get on the plane. That was pretty wild. But yeah, so it was coming to Phillip Island was great, and to be honest, the biggest thing that I or the best thing I'd say that I remember from racing Phillip Island was just like riding the World Championship, MotoGP World Championship in front of your home crowd.
Yeah,
it was just the coolest thing ever. It was just, again, another one of those things that I keep close to me that I just remember and, very grateful for sure. Like it was just, best thing ever.
100%. And
points as well, I believe.
Yeah, so I think at Phillip Island, I think I might have finished 15th.
Yeah.
Actually, I had a look back at the results there the other night. I think it was 15th. So, scored a point. It was funny, my partner Chrissy, she was asking me about it. I said, oh, I'm sure I didn't finish that far behind Bautista because Bautista gone back to Racing World Superbike and obviously done Unreal. And I said, I'm sure I didn't finish that far behind him. I look back, I think it was 2 or 3 seconds or something behind him. Like, let's see, it could have been Wilson.
Could have been me.
That's brilliant. So to score a point in the MotoGP Championship was just another one of those things.
That's history. You're going to be in history forever for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we were talking about this earlier. Like, people take it for granted. It's not an easy thing to do. Like, there's not a lot of people that can say, I've, participated in one first and foremost and then scored points.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and look, and that was, one thing is you're exactly that. You get a chance to ride in the GP. Like, that, that's a massive thing on its own. But, again, to be anywhere even near able to score some points. And I put that down a lot to Davide and Paolo because they, especially Davide, he come up to me the first time I got on the bike, grabbed me by the shirt on his shoulders and just shook me in my face. He goes, "Don't crash the bike." What's worse than like...
That's terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. Getting out of the motorcycle and shitting yourself at don't crash the bike, but it paid dividends in the end, managed to score a point at Phillip Islands, and it was all good.
And he's a stern operator. We met him and he was like, he's on.
He's a funny character, that's for sure.
Unreal. What an experience. But imagine that, you're like, okay.
Yeah, he puts the wind up, that's for sure. No
wonder Ducati's doing so good these days. Got him behind and just shaking all the riders.
Go faster.
Wouldn't want to get on his bad side, that's for sure.
No, you're definitely not on the bad side, definitely not. I couldn't imagine it being too good for you.
Oh, God, no. Stop that.
So, flicking it back to ASBK, three-time ASBK champion, 2015 on the ZX10, 2019 on the Pani 1299, and 2022 on the R1. What's the feeling like going into those seasons? Do you, like you mentioned a bit earlier on, you feel like you're on, you're ready to go, you're a chance to be at the pointy end? And then once you're at the pointy end, crossing that line, what's the feeling like of winning that championship? Going, man, like, I've done it.
Yeah, look, I think, so 2015 is one that it's one that has to be said. Like, I was racing the ASBK at that point. There wasn't the factory teams weren't in there. Not all the riders were there because it was a split between ASBK and Formula Extreme.
Yeah.
So that year, a lot of the best riders of the country were racing in FX, and they weren't racing ASBK. So, like, that year was a different. I was still quite young. I think it might have been my second year on a superbike, and I was still learning a lot. So I was racing ASBK and FX to try and just do as much riding and seat time as possible and everything. But yeah, so the one in that year in ASBK was just a matter of going and riding, and whoever was racing in that time, like, I was able to win the races and win that championship. But that one in, once we went to 2019, everyone's back in the championship. All the competitions there, so you're back to real hard racing, and at that, this 2019 was a funny one because right at the start of the year, that was I was intending to go back and race in Spain because I'd just come off 2017 was in Europe, 2018 I was in the Spanish championship. Yep. I was intending to go back in racing the Spanish Superbike Championship in 2019. So at the start of the year, wasn't really intending to do the ASBK. I was just going to do a couple of rounds as a pre-season before I headed overseas. But how that came about, Troy ended up Troy Bayliss was going to be riding that bike that I end up racing on. He crashed at the first round, I think, and injured his fingers and busted himself up a little bit, and he couldn't continue on. So he asked me to race the bike. So that was a funny one for the start of it. I never sort of really went into it thinking to challenge for the championship. Yeah. I was just like, it was just another, you know, chance to go racing and just to basically keep the dream alive, you know, to just an opportunity to go racing. But as the season went on, it sort of became apparent that, okay, we're in the hunt, we're at the pointy end, we can challenge for championship. And it was just become a little bit more sort of strategic about trying to just get the best result that you possibly could based on the circumstances that you had each round, rather than sort of going for all out, I'm going to win this race or whatever. Because at that time, I think it might have been Herfoss and Maxwell were probably the two guys that were like that you'd think would win the championship that year. Pretty sure those two guys were on. I can't really remember exactly how it went down. I don't know if they had some DNF or what happened, but anyway, I was in the hunt for it. So, we went to the final round, and that's like, I think I needed to win both races to win the championship. And that was the first time that I was like, just like eyes lit up and all the concentration came, focus and everything, and just got the job done. Like, so, the feeling of that, winning that championship was emotional, but it was like, it's had been so many years of riding and racing and practicing and building up to it that it was just like a massive relief almost, you know? So, and it was really cool to do it, I guess, against like all your competitors. Yeah. The only thing that hindered on that one was that it was a 1299 Ducati and it was the fastest bloody bike on the whole track. So I knew that. I knew that the bike was so quick. But it's a hard one because you've got more power doesn't necessarily mean it's easier to ride or it's, you know, all that type of stuff. You still got to get the power to the ground. Anyway, in my mind, it's still like, well, okay, I won the championship, you know, but everyone else is still like, but you're on the faster bike. Okay. So the 2022 championship for me on the R1 was the best one because you couldn't say that the bike was better than the others. If anything, probably a little bit on the back foot compared to the V4 at that point. And again, it was with everyone were there, you know, like proper championships. So for me, that one was one that I went into. I just signed with Yamaha at the start of 2022.
Yeah.
And I was fully committed to going there and trying to win races and win the championship. So in terms of a feeling, I was just motivated and just keen to do as much training, as much riding and just do everything that I could to try and do my best at the races. So I'd turn up to the races just ready to do the best, and more than anything, just from a mental point of view, I was just keen, just hungry.
Yeah.
And as the season progressed on, like the team was working together really, really well. Something that you'd just expect, like coming into the team, it was new for me that year. You'd think it might take maybe a few rounds or like maybe even the whole year to sort of gel and get everything together, but it just clicked off really good straight up. We were working together great. And so like, it was just like, we're on, like straight from the first round. I was like, oh, we're on here. We can do this. And every weekend that we went to, it was just like, yeah, we can do it. We just kept doing it. And we were just, come away with a lot of wins that year. And, ultimately ended up winning the championship. And that was a funny, funny feeling right after that, because we'd had, we'd enjoyed so much success through the year with a lot of race wins and round wins. And celebrated them so much, like, and it was so ecstatic to get them. But once I won that final race, well, I didn't win the race. I came, I don't know, maybe sixth in the race, but won the championship. Yeah. It's just like, I just relaxed, like just, I can take it easy now. It had been so intense.
You did all the groundwork.
Yeah, but it was so intense. It was a lot of hard work, and it was a lot of commitment and dedication to get that championship from not only myself, it was everybody in the team to do that. So really put a lot of pressure, I think, on everybody in the team to try and raise their level and get the best out of it. So at the end of it, I was just like, oh, thank fuck we did it. So that was, you know, that was the sensation, the feeling for that. It's interesting, like winning the championship like that, then trying to carry that into the following season, because you come into the next year with the number one plate on the bike.
Yeah.
Probably a whole lot of expectation. You've just won a lot last year and all this type of stuff. So, yeah, it creates a whole new mentality and how to try to manage all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's funny how racing, it's, you know, it's one thing is a skill and the ability to ride the bike, but the rest of it's all in your head. So
yeah, all between the ears for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
And it was first win for Yamaha in quite a while when you jumped back on, I believe.
Yeah, so like again, in terms of the ASBK championship, like so they did go through a stage there where I think Yamaha are racing the FX championship, so there wasn't really much going on with ASBK. But the last ASBK Superbike championship they run was, I think, 2007 with Jamie Stouffer, I'm pretty sure it was. So it'd been like 15 years.
Yeah.
Gee, that's a long time.
Since they'd won the official ASBK championship. And obviously that's a pretty cool feat to have, like to come and jump on the bike and then take him to the championship that year. Like, yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah, just all sort of gelled and clicked together and unreal.
100%. And being on a Yamaha, running 46,
It really did. And couldn't have worked out any better.
Absolutely.
You should have got an invite to Rossi's ranch after that.
Oh, right. I mean, come on. We'll tag him in this clip and make sure we get up, get him up there.
He'll go, who's this guy? Never heard of him before. Did I race against him? What happened? Would know who I am.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Apparently he knows about it, just about everyone that buddy puts their leg over a motorbike.
Yeah, true. It's actually quite surprising at like how much he like knows and takes an interest in, you know what I mean? Like he doesn't just he doesn't go to the racetrack and just focus on his own stuff. He's across the board. Like he knows everything across the board, you know, like he's all over it. Yeah. He's passionate for it. He's super passionate for it, I think.
Yeah. It's definitely great for the sport when people are like that, for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you get to say g'day to him when you raced against him?
To be honest, I can't really remember. I don't think I did, hey. Oh, I don't think geez. I did. Yeah. It was such a funny one because, like how I just said then about he's got his, like he's across the board and everything. Yeah. I was just there at the track, like in the pit box or, you know, at the hotel. I was just like me and my team and that was it. Like I didn't have any time for anything else. Like,
fair. That makes sense.
And look, I think also too, you know, maybe those guys, because they're together and been around, they might catch up or whatever here and there, but when you're on the outside, you're just nobody else. So
yeah, in a circle. In a sanctum.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on ASBK at the moment? We've spoken to a few people, and you know they seem to find the breaks in between racing too long. What can be done to sort of, I guess, promote the series better and bring more eyes to it? You know, we're seeing BSB's huge, AMA's starting to really ramp back up and become a huge series. Like, you know, we want to be there mixing it with the rest and, you know, get all eyes on you guys.
Yeah, definitely. Look, that's a tough question. Yeah. I don't have a good answer for that. I mean, I feel like that our racing, like the product that you've got, like if you're looking at it from a marketing point of view, you know what I mean? Like the actual product that you're working with is great. Like
it's high level.
That's right. If you watch some of those races, especially like take for example last year, man, some of those races between say me and Herfoss Herfoss and Waters or you know whatever,
it was crazy.
Like the good thing is it's entertainment and it's entertaining watching those races because you don't know who's going to win the race until they cross the finish line. You know what I mean? Like it goes right down to the last turn, the last lap. So, a little bit hard to say how to go about that. I mean, I'm out of depth. That's not because I think that like as a rider, like I think they're doing pretty well in that regard, I guess. Yeah. The only thing to say is like I said, like there's big gaps. We have a 7-round championship and it gets spread from the end of February till early December time. So, I mean, when you think about only doing 7 weekends of racing and you're taking up, what's that ends up being like 40 something weeks of the year, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like they could probably, to keep interest in it and keep people, you know, engaged, maybe you need to try and like sort of, you know, bring it a little bit closer together and like keep things happening a little bit faster, you know. That's the only thing I can think. Otherwise, I mean, what do? You smash everything on social media. We've got TV coverage.
Yep.
I think it's like, I don't know, I have a very limited understanding about supercars and that type of thing, but that's a different sort of, like you don't have, my understanding is that you have the teams are bought into the championship, like they've got an involvement in it, like a stake in it type thing, you know.
Yep.
It's different here. We got, you know, ASBK trying to run it and the reality is that, well, now we're down to Yamaha's the only factory team, you know what I mean? So like being able to, like, you know, we had Yamaha and Honda really, and whilst Ducati's involved, to a certain extent, and BMW a little bit, like you sort of, you need to have the trucks turn up, you need to have all the brands, you know, you need to have all that stuff sorted
all
first.
The backing as well.
Yeah, yeah, from that point of view, I think. And then they could probably look at doing something a bit more. But yeah, I mean, I'm a rider.
Fair. That's fair. The backing 100% from the bike industry, I think, is obviously crucial. And you see as well, V8 Supercars is going through it right now. Like Brody Kostecki, I don't know how much you follow all that stuff, you know, he's having all those issues and people saying like, well, V8 Supercars is on the decline and, you know, it could be due to giving more personality to the sport, you know, getting more in depth with like yourself or other riders. And we find that out speaking to yourself or Brian or we've had a chat to Troy at the pub and everything like that. That's what helps bring sports these days to the fold. And even Lukey Luke was talking about that. He used to go around videoing and interviewing riders and like getting them to, you know, say stuff.
Yeah, just say funny stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's a big thing because people love to follow a personality more than anything.
Yeah, for sure. And look, I mean, from a fan's point of view, people who are watching the races, typically they're going to follow one rider, you know, or okay, maybe a couple, but you know what I mean? Like they're going to follow, like they say, they're going to follow Mike Jones. And when Mike's racing against Herfoss, well, they're barracking for me, you know what I mean? And you have Herfoss's fans barracking for Herfoss. So yeah, you need to have that, the rider's personality available to them to be able to connect with, you know,
and they have the freedom to be able to be yourself.
Yeah, sure. I think there's definitely a case of things are, you're trying to do the right things by sponsors
of
or
course,
you know, brands and that kind of stuff, so you ended up don't being yourself all the time, you know what I mean? You'd
correct.
Be this sort of image for what you think is supposed to be the right thing to do, you know. So look, that's for sure, that's an element to it and something that can, I think the problem is that there's just so much across the whole board that probably you can tweak and refine and make better, you know. But yeah, that makes sense to me, trying to bring the riders' personalities out. And and I know that they've been trying to make an effort of doing that to a certain extent with the rivalry. So I know they've been trying to get, like last year I could see they were trying to sort of, not that they script it at all, but they try to make a, you know, a scenario where they put Herfoss against Waters against me, sort of put us together and then prompt you with a few questions to try and get some emotion out of you, you know what I mean? So, and look, but you need to have that again so that people that are watching, if they're siding, you know, they're your fan or whatever, they're siding with you, well, then they can see what you're thinking or what's going on. So, it's a hard one. I feel like you could just solve all your problems with more money, I guess.
100%.
Of course,
Netflix still deal on ASB tabs.
But the thing is, like when you look at it like that, you've already got all the TV cameras there and that. I guess you'd need more. You'd still need to have more staff and more people to be getting more shots and stuff in the pits and the garages and whatever. But I mean, we already got a lot of the stuff there for the on-track action, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Be something that'd be bloody cool if you could make it happen.
That's what it does need. And not to obviously pump our own tires up, but like podcast is a massive thing and bringing light to that. And not just ourselves, like Gypsy Tales is huge. That fella from Talk and Chatter as well. He does all the good stuff. So it's good to have a community where we can speak to you like a couple of times a year. And then it's probably a bit easier with long form conversation, especially where you can get in depth, because you're not going to get anything out of a 5-minute interview. Let's be honest.
100%.
So that does change. And it's obviously interesting for us and very interesting for the listener. And like, we've already had so much feedback, get more ASBK riders on. Cause I feel like a lot of times, a lot of people don't get the platform as well to speak their story or whatever it is, you know, and that's what can help build sports, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, and being able to have an avenue for riders to be able to exactly do what we're doing now, which is, you know, putting my thoughts whatever's in my head coming out and for people to watch and listen to and whatever. If you didn't have this going on, well then that'd be, you know, be a waste, you know what I mean? So I think that it's definitely beneficial.
Yeah.
But it's almost like, you know, there's only a small part that you can do, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like you can't fix it all with just like, hey, we're going to do podcasts. That's something that fixes everything, you know what I mean?
Right.
But you need to have that part going, but you also need to have all the other bits going at the same time to really bring it up.
Boost it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, ASPK, if you're listening, get us on. We'll do something in the back of the pits every round, no dramas. You know, we'll make it interesting for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. So with the, like we mentioned, the long breaks, what are you doing in between that for bike time? Are you doing local club racing, getting out to tracks and just doing ride days?
Yeah, so I mean, like at the start of the year is always, the rounds are usually close together, sort of one a month type thing. So in between those rounds, try and do some track days or, stuff locally. And usually the team will try and do a test at the circuit we're going to race at, beforehand. Keep your eye in on the bike. That's the main thing. Big thing for me is, I'd spend all my time just going and riding the pushy or training or something like that. So, that sort of fills in my time. The thing about last year with a big break, I think it's slimmed up a little bit. It's not quite as big a break this time. I can't remember how many weeks it is, but it's not quite as big a break as last year. Last year we had three months, I think
it was. Huge. Like
12 weeks. Yeah, it was massive. So it was a strange one because I didn't feel like mentally you couldn't switch off and like have a break because you're like, I still got to go racing. And if I just give up now, basically like switch off and just give up, or it's like, well, how am I going to get back to going?
That's
racing
right.
Again?
How are you going to switch back on?
I'm like, I've got to just keep going. So I just kept training and just kept going, practicing, kept riding, trying to keep my skills up. And it almost like was, to me, it was like, all right, here's an opportunity that maybe I can get some sort of advantage over the other guys. They might be taking a bit of a break or something.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to go to the track and try and ride and like keep getting my skills, going. So keep my eye in. So, I didn't stop. I just kept going. So, nice. But it's been all my life, like riding bikes. So you just keep doing it,
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to do anything else.
That's fair. And it always seems to be the common thing, motorcycles and cycling.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I don't really know why that is. I guess two wheels, but cycling's just what I've found is it's really beneficial to keeping you fit on the motorbike.
Of course.
The cycling with the from the a legs point of view, like you don't realize it, but on a motorbike you are like very dominant with your legs. Like everything about the bike is with your legs because you're trying to actually be quite relaxed with your arms
and upper body.
Yeah, try not to be too much input into the bars because that can actually can be more of a hindrance than a benefit. So you actually try to do a lot with your legs and even with your core. So cycling's great for that. And then just from an aerobic point of view, like it's just something that like you get out for maybe 3 or 4 hours cycling, like you probably can't really find too many other things you can do for 3 or 4 hours that give you sort of that aerobic benefit that you could stay mentally sort of interested in,
yeah,
you know what
right.
I mean? So it just seems to work. So I certainly enjoy it. I know there's a mix of people, a lot of people don't do cycling, but I find it really good. I also enjoy riding, so that's a road bike, but I also enjoy riding the mountain bike as well. And for me that's kind of handy because whilst the road bike's good for fitness training, you can
switch off a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So with the mountain bike, it keeps your brain switched on, that's for sure, because you're riding on a narrow trail with trees and stuff around you. So, and the technical trails and all that kind of stuff. So, that's good training all around, really. Yeah, good for the fitness, good for the mind. I enjoy doing a bit of both for sure.
Yeah, awesome.
I can tell with the cycling tan lines.
I mean, the days have been pretty warm up home, and like I said, I've been out. Like you get going pretty early. I still leave home like around 5:30 in the morning, but you're out there for a few hours, and then the sun's pretty brutal. Even at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. So
yeah, you get a bit crisp.
Getting after it.
Get a bit of a tan going on.
That's right. I got a running singlet's terrible tan line at the moment. It's shocking.
That would be horrendous.
I'm too scared. Yeah, Daniel can vouch.
It's bad.
Keep your t-shirt on, eh?
Yeah, that's it. That's why we don't release Republica singlets.
Or do a pod shirtless.
Yeah. Oh, that's probably more for me. I don't want to see that.
No, I can't juice.
KFC, if you're listening, sponsor me.
He knows all the herbs and spices. Do you keep up to date with watching Supers and MotoGP and stuff like that?
A little bit. I mean, I did used to watch MotoGP like quite a lot years ago, but I don't follow it anywhere near as much now. But I still enjoy keeping an eye on it and whatnot. same for World Superbike. Like World Superbike's probably a little bit more relatable for me because I know some of the guys in it, and whatnot. So yeah, I enjoy watching a bit of World Superbike. I definitely don't watch it like every weekend, you know.
Yeah.
But I enjoy keeping an eye on it.
No, so that's cool.
Yeah.
I love it. Do you find, because you've done, I guess you kind of already answered the question, but is it a bit more relatable, I guess, because you have ridden either a Grand Prix bike or a super bike, or
yeah, that's it. I suppose I like to a certain extent, not fully, but I got a little bit of an understanding of like what they're feeling or what they're going through. So when you watch them when they're riding, and you know, you're thinking in your head what they're doing and all that kind of stuff, it is a lot more relatable for sure. Yeah, if you don't have that experience with those types of bikes, you're just watching it purely for the entertainment, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, watching the passes or the crashes and that type of excitement. So,
that's all right.
Yeah, for sure. It's relatable. And as a rider, like, I'm very analytical with my riding. So if I do watch it and I'm watching the guys, I'm wondering what they're doing and what's going on. So,
that's fair. That's
definitely.
Way to look at it.
And it's interesting as well, going back to right at the start of the podcast, you said, you know, you like being on rails and, you know, you can really feel if you just move a little bit, and it's obviously because like you've done road your whole life, so there's none of that dirt track background where you see Jack Miller or something who loves sliding it. That's natural.
100%. Yeah, exactly that. Like, yeah, so from pretty much, yeah, whatever it was, 10 or 11 years old, like it's been on the bitumen. So my sensation and my feeling with the traction, like I think it's very refined or very sensitive. And that's just because exactly that, you've just spent so much time specifically with bitumen.
Yeah, yeah, honing the craft.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, dialed in.
That's right.
That's good, Phil. What's your best piece of advice you'd give either a young person or even someone that's a little bit older that wants to get into racing, whether it's to try and make it into the world stage, Australian stage, or even just local, you know, state championship?
Yeah, look, I think, initially the best way to go is to try and start somewhere that's affordable, you know what I mean? Like whether that's club racing or track days or whatever you can afford to do and to get into. I guess it depends on the level that you want to take it to as to how serious you want to get with it. But, and that's like, again, this is probably determined by the financial circumstance that you're in. But yeah, look, I think the biggest thing is to try and have fun with it. I'd say take everything on board, every bit of advice on board that you can. Don't discard anything. Take that on board. Apply it yourself. Try it. See how it works for you. And then you can make a decision on whether you want to use it or not use it. That's from a riding point of view. And then something to me that's always worked is if you do want to progress and try and do better with your riding, like just try and get as much track time as you possibly can. You just can't beat seat time.
Yeah.
If you're in a position and you're keen, you want to go do it, and you're a young kid or something that aspires to race in the world championship or go to a higher level, then yeah, just try and ride as much as you can, as much as you possibly can, because seat time, you just can't beat it for sure.
We love it. Very
love
good.
It. Love
awesome.
It. That's it, I reckon.
It is. We did. I don't know if the viewers will see now.
Yeah.
Our other co-host did make an appearance. I don't know if he's still here. He has dropped something last minute.
Yeah. So. Yeah. He's raced down with all our gifts from Melbourne. He got stuck in Melbourne for about 2 extra days, unfortunately for him. So we do have a bit of a surprise for you, as we do for everyone that jumps on our pod. We will write a message and stuff to you as well. But it's just to say thanks. We've got a one of one. Thanks to Stacey from HJC Australia. Just a bit of a thanks for coming on.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the time, man.
Got a lot of surprise. Yeah. Hey. I wasn't expecting that. So
oh, beautiful.
Yeah, perfect. I actually just rearranged one of my rooms at home and got a bookshelf type thing with all my helmets and trophies in there. So that'll go up there, no worries.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, send us a photo. Yeah. That's up there. Get it on the Instagram.
We'll get it on there,
Dead center. We want it in the middle. Some candles lit around it, a bit of a shrine. That'll be good.
Awesome. Mike, you've been unreal.
Yeah.
We've been trying to tee this up for ages, so it's awesome that we've gotten it done. Mate, good luck this weekend. Good luck for the season and happy birthday for Sunday.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for having us on.
No worries, man.
Thanks, Mike. Cheers.
Cheers, guys.